Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. And become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Today's episode of Chilling Tales for Dark Nights is proudly brought to you by HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. I'll be back after our first story tonight to tell you a little bit more about our experience with HelloFresh and how they can help make your life just a bit easier and far more delicious. Plus, they've got a special offer for those of you in our listening audience. Until then, settle in, get cozy, and prepare to be unsettled. The show is about to begin. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling Tales for Dark Nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's program, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with audio adaptations of three rounds of frightening fiction about books with bite, conniving creatures, and the darkest of deeds. I'm your host, Steve Taylor. Tonight, I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your wildest imaginations. Joining us tonight to help bring our frightening fiction to life are voice actors Andrew Berrios, Jonathan West, and Heather Thomas. Now, get your ticket ready, take your seat in our theater of the minds, and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale tonight is brought to us courtesy of an author who goes by the name Clarimond and is voiced by Andrew Berrios. In it, our protagonist discovers a book that, contrary to the old adage, is so bad, he can't wait to put it down. Without further ado, I present to you the tale of Roly Poly.
The book doesn't look particularly creepy. There are no ominous images on the cover. No words of foreboding. There's only plain red canvas with gold letters that read, "The Tale of Roly Poly." I never saw the book until Jenny pulled it from her collection on the shelf. It may have been left by the previous owners. We had only moved to this neighborhood a month ago. Jenny was already snuggled under the covers when I opened the book. At 6, she was starting to read and never needed to be coaxed to bed if I promised her a story. Well, almost never. Princesses were her new obsession, and we'd covered most of the classics, like Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella. The Tale of Roly Poly was a departure from the usual set list. "Are you sure you want this one, Pumpkin?" Jenny yawned. "Yes, Daddy." I shrugged and began to read. "There were two boys. Two children like you. One was called Jack. The other was Hugh. The boys sat in their room, for there was nothing to do. They were so bored. A common bugaboo." The book contained a simple illustration of two boys in a bedroom, decorated with baseball-themed wallpaper. "They thought and they thought. They huffed and they puffed. Until Hugh said, 'Phew! Enough is enough. Let's play a game. We'll upend this loose end.' 'I know,' said Jack. 'I'll call on my friend.'" I groaned internally and hoped that Jenny would fall asleep soon. This wasn't exactly Dr. Seuss. Jack took the book and said the words written down, "Come out, come out, you silly old clown." With a wish and a whoosh and a fizzle and pop, Roly Poly arrived with a great big plop. There was an enormous figure that dwarfed the two boys next to him. The man was dressed as a traditional pantomime clown, complete with a rough, white makeup and garish red lips. "How do," said the clown. "I've come to play." "You?" said Hugh. "Oh dear, holy moly." "Don't be scared," declared Jack. "It's just Roly Poly." "What shall we do?" said Hugh, all aflutter, as he pulled out his toys from the bedroom clutter. There were many games of various names, all wires and megawatts. A singing machine, a trampoline. There were even two robots. "Oh no," said the clown, "this will not do. Let's play some real games. Ditch this techno voodoo. Come with me and you'll see. My home is quite grand. You'll have all that you need in topsy-turvy land." The two boys nodded, their hearts filled with glee. They took the clown's hand and counted 3 Mississippi. Hugh and Jack closed their eyes as their world twirled and twirled. They whooped with joy as a new land unfurled. The clown's home was quite splendid. Full of candies and treats, the fun never ended. No parents, no chores, no bedtime or rules, no horrible homework from boring old schools. The boys played and played, and all 3 were glad, until one fateful day, when the clown became sad. "What's wrong, Roly Poly? Is there something we can do?" The boys asked and asked, but their worry still grew. "Oh dear," the clown mumbled. "My apologies, most humbled. I'm just very hungry," as his large tummy rumbled. "Would you like chocolate? Or chips? or gooey cream cake? We have hot dogs and ice cream and every milkshake. But the clown shook his head, for his belly did ache. Then he grabbed little Hugh. "A fine meal you will make." My stomach flipped when I saw the contents of the next page. I shut the book immediately. "Let's call it a night, princess." Ginny tried to protest, but her eyelids were heavy with sleep. "What happened to the boy, Daddy?" "I'll tell you tomorrow." I kissed Ginny on the forehead and turned out the light. I went downstairs and poured a large glass of wine before reopening the book. The page that I'd closed contained an illustration of a gruesome scene. The clown held one of the boys above his head and had bitten into the child's left side. His teeth tore away chunks of pink flesh as blood trickled down his ruby-stained lips. The boy's eyes were shut, his tear-streaked face frozen in an agonized expression. Spurred on by morbid curiosity, I continued to read. Roly-poly grabbed the boy and held him aloft. He took a big bite. Sweet Hugh was so soft. He gnashed and he gnawed. He chewed and he slurped. And when nothing was left, the clown loudly burped. He looked around. There was no Jack to be found. The boy had run. The chase had begun. Jack ducked and he darted. He ran and he ran. Roly-poly just chuckled. "Come back here, young man. This place is large. Indeed, it does sprawl. There is no way out. No way at all." The clown was quite right, for try as he might, Jack rushed to escape, but there was no exit in sight. The boy grew tired. His breath became weary. Roly-poly caught up, sounding quite cheery. "You're tougher than most. You, I will cook." And he hung the boy up on an old meat hook. The child screamed and he shouted, "You great fat liar." The clown licked his lips as he stoked the big fire. I turned to the last page. The boy dangled from a hook over a gaping fire pit. Parts of his skin were cracked and blackened as flames licked his small frame. The clown prodded the fire with a stick in one hand. The other hand waved to the reader as a maniacal smile revealed two rows of long, sharp teeth. The clown was so happy. This sweet meat was a treat. "Hail to the chef. Bon appetit." The book ended there. I felt the bile rise in the back of my throat. What kind of a twisted individual writes something like this? It was probably a desperate hack writer looking for some notoriety. Whatever it was, it left a bad taste in my mouth. I finished my wine and threw the book in the trash. I woke up early the next morning and took the paper lying on the doorstep. It was Sunday, but I never liked to sleep in. I put on a pot of coffee and glanced at the headline on the countertop. My heart froze. 5th anniversary of local boy's disappearance. Hundreds have taken part in a remembrance rally to mark the 5th anniversary of the disappearance of brothers Hugh and Jack Healy. The brothers, aged 8 and 6, were abducted from their home on January 7th, 2012. Police have issued a fresh appeal for information this weekend. Story continued on page 3. I ran outside and removed the cover of the trash can. Perhaps whoever wrote that book knew something about the boy's disappearance. At the very least, I needed to report this sick material to the police. My stomach lurched as I regarded the contents of the can. The book was gone. A primal panic rose in my chest as I dashed upstairs to Ginny's bedroom. A single piece of paper lay atop the crumpled sheets of her empty bed. Ginny picked a good book, a true tale to excite. But her dad did not like it. He thought it was trite. He stopped the story at the moment of glory. Oh no, not for you. This part is unfit. The clown did not like that. Not one little bit. So Roly-Poly told Ginny, who was ever so skinny, "Let's have some fun. We'll show that old ninny." And now Ginny plays in the land topsy-turvy, full of sugar and spice, and all things that are girly. While the princess holds court in dresses of satin, the clown simply smiles. She'll do. She'll fatten. It's been 1 week since Ginny went missing. I've given the page to the cops, but they're as baffled as I am. Every hellish verse of that awful book is seared into my skull. I can't sleep. I can't eat. I'm typing this as both an appeal and a warning. If you find this book, don't open it. Don't read it. Call the police. A child's life may depend on it.
I hope you enjoyed the tale of Roly-Poly by Arthur Clarimonde, as performed by Andrew Berrios. Up next, we've got another terrifying tale for you. This one a creepypasta classic from an author who goes only by the name Perfect Circle 35, about a most unusual and determined entity just outside your window who can't wait to play. But first, I'd like to tell you a bit more about our experience with tonight's sponsor, HelloFresh. As I mentioned at the top of the show, HelloFresh is a meal delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. And this past few months, the crew here at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights had a chance to try out the service, and I've got to tell you, we were impressed. After signing up, our director, Craig, who's got a family of five, including three boys of his own, you know they eat a lot in that house, returned home to find his very first HelloFresh box on his doorstep with not one but three full meals ready to prepare in a box, complete with ice packs to keep everything in pristine condition, even after making the trip all the way from New York to his home in Wisconsin. And HelloFresh didn't skimp. The meals had everything needed to make the meals that same day, with the exception of basics everyone's got, such as salt and pepper and a stick of butter. It could not have been easier to make a home-cooked meal that tasted like something out of a gourmet restaurant. And that's what's so great about HelloFresh. It's restaurant quality, home-cooked, and made simple. Whether you're an aspiring chef or don't think you could live without your microwave, the service makes it easy for anyone to conquer the kitchen with delicious, healthy recipes that are easy to follow. The ingredients are fresh and pre-measured, and every meal comes with an easy-to-follow 6-step pictured recipe card. And it's all delivered each and every week straight to your door in a special insulated box. So even if it arrives while you're at work, you don't have to worry about a thing. And best of all of HelloFresh's meals come together in 30 minutes max. Call for less than 2 pots and pans and require minimal cleanup. Because the last thing you want to do after providing for your family and working hard all day is stare at an enormous pile of dishes. The entire service is designed to allow you to spend less time meal planning and grocery shopping and free up your time to do more of the things you love. And the dinners you'll end up with are fuss-free. HelloFresh has gone out of their way to make sure kids and the pickiest of eaters will approve of its family plan recipes. Our director Craig told us his kids loved every part of the meals, from helping to cook to how it tasted, and they even craved the leftovers. Now, since when does that happen with anything these days other than mac and cheese? Just saying. HelloFresh made everything enjoyable and easy for Craig and his family. The whole process was a great activity that helped bring them together. Kind of the point. The 5 of them decided together which of the 3 meals they got all at once they would make the first night, and they settled on HelloFresh's Italian meatloaf with roasted green beans and mashed potatoes, and it took less than 20 minutes to make the first meal. Not only that, but like I mentioned before, everything they needed was included, except for a stick of butter and a pinch of salt and pepper. In the box, there was fresh basil right off the stem, shallots, garlic, a generous pile of Yukon Gold potatoes, alongside the best beef Craig says he's ever tasted, freshly picked beans, and even the milk and sour cream. Because of all this, Craig was able to spend less time worrying and more time around the table with the people he loves most, enjoying a hot meal he made himself. What a way to feel accomplished after a long day at the office, without needing to leave the comfort of your home to buy a dozen ingredients for just one meal. In the same box, Craig also received all the ingredients necessary to make pork carnitas tacos with pickled onion and Monterey Jack cheese, and my personal favorite, cheesy stuffed barbecue pork burgers with charred pineapple and sweet potato fries. Man, my mouth is watering just thinking about it. Sound too good to be true? It's not. And it gets better yet. HelloFresh gives you so many choices. For example, if meat's not your thing, there's a vegetarian option too, alongside their classic and family plans. And you can switch between the options whenever your tastes change at no extra cost. That's right. Just update your preferences and you're all set for the next week. And now you can enjoy a fun menu featuring HelloFresh's brand new options, such as their dinner to lunch and 20-minute meals programs, or their gourmet and one-pot wonders choices. The only thing HelloFresh doesn't do for you is cook the meal. But making a table of tasty eats doesn't get any better or easier than this. And I think once you give this service a try, you'll never go back to eating out again. Who wants overpriced chain restaurant cuisine or greasy burgers and fries when you can put something unique and delicious on your table 3 days a week with HelloFresh, without needing to pile everyone in the car to go anywhere? In a busy world, HelloFresh just makes sense. So get out of that recipe rut and start cooking outside of your comfort zone by discovering new delicious recipes with HelloFresh today. And to show their appreciation and to make it easy for you to sign up now, HelloFresh is offering our listeners a fantastic deal. For $80 off your first month of HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com/CTDN80 and enter CTDN80. It's like getting 8 meals for free. Once again, just go to HelloFresh.com/CTDN80 and enter CTDN80. That's CTDN80, all one word. The promo code will let them know that Steve and the team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights sent you. Thanks so much for listening and for giving HelloFresh a try this month.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
True Scary Story is a podcast about personal, terrifying stories dealing with the paranormal. True accounts from people who live through strange and supernatural experiences, told directly by them. My name is Edwin Covarrubias, and for years I have been listening to stories from people who have shared their most frightening true experiences with me. There was one story recently called There's Something in the Closet, where Juanita tells us about her experiences growing up in a house where she would see objects physically move on their own, but the rest of her family would act as if nothing was happening. It wasn't until years later that she found out what the source of it all was. Which makes me wonder, if you were to witness a haunting, who would believe you? Come find True Scary Story by typing it into your app right now. I'll see you over there on True Scary Story. Horror Story is a podcast about strange and mysterious true horrors. My name is Edwin Covarrubias, host and producer of Horror Story. In the show, I have an episode called There's a Stranger in Your Walls, and it's about a woman that moved out of her home because she thought it was being haunted. But the truth happened to be even scarier than the ghosts. Other stories dive deep into the supernatural, like the one of the most infamous cases of real ghosts, called The Haunting in San Pedro. But if you're into mysteries, learn about the pilot who disappeared in the sky. All of these and more are available on Horror Story right now, with more episodes coming out every single week. You can search for the podcast by typing in Horror Story on your podcast app right now. The show is the one with the yellow letters. I'll see you over there on Horror Story.
Now that we've freed up your schedule by making it easier to make dinner, you've got some extra time to kill. So why not spend it with us, listening in as we spin another terrifying tale? Up next, we move out of the kitchen, but not out of the frying pan, as we follow one man in his search to find out whether his traumatic childhood memories were nothing but a hallucination, or something far more real than he could ever imagine. From author Perfect Circle 35, as brought to life by voice actor Jonathan West, I present to you, Mr. Widemouth.
During my childhood, my family was like a drop of water in a vast river, never remaining in one location for long. We settled in Rhode Island when I was 8, and there we remained until I went to college in Colorado Springs. Most of my memories are rooted in Rhode Island, but there are fragments in the attic of my brain which belong to the various homes we had lived in when I was much younger. Most of these memories are unclear and pointless, chasing after another boy in the backyard of a house in North Carolina, trying to build a raft to float on the creek behind the apartment we rented in Pennsylvania. But there is one set of memories which remains as clear as glass, as though they were just made yesterday. I often wonder whether these memories are simply lucid dreams produced by the long sickness I experienced that spring. But in my heart, I know that they're real. We were living in a house just outside the bustling metropolis of New Vineyard, Maine, population 643. It was a large structure, especially for a family of three. There were a number of rooms that I didn't even see in the 5 months we resided there. In some ways, it was a waste of space, but it was the only house on the market at the time, at least within an hour's commute to my father's place of work. The day after my 5th birthday, attended by my parents alone, I came down with a fever. The doctor said I had mononucleosis, which meant no rough play, and more fever for at least another 3 weeks. It was horrible timing to be bedridden. We were in the process of packing our things to move to Pennsylvania, and most of my things were already packed away in boxes, leaving my room pretty barren. My mother brought me ginger ale and books several times a day, and these served the function of being my primary form of entertainment for the next few weeks. Boredom always loomed just around the corner, waiting to rear its ugly head and compound my misery. I don't exactly recall how I met Mr. Widemouth. I think it was about a week after I was diagnosed with mono. My first memory of the small creature was asking him if he had a name. He told me to call him Mr. Widemouth, because his mouth was large. In fact, everything about him was large in comparison to his body. His head, his eyes, his crooked ears. But his mouth was by far the largest.
"You look kinda like a Furby," I said as he flipped through one of my books.
Mr. Widemouth stopped and gave me a puzzled look.
"Furby? What's a Furby?"
he asked. I shrugged.
"You know, the toy. The little robot with the big ears. You can pet him and feed him, almost like a real pet."
"Oh,"
Mr. Widemouth resumed his activity.
"You don't need one of those. They aren't the same as having a real friend."
I remember Mr. Widemouth disappearing every time my mother stopped in to check in on me.
"I lay under your bed,"
he later explained.
"I don't want your parents to see me because, you know, I'm afraid they won't let us play anymore."
We didn't do much during those first few days. Mr. Widemouth just looked at my books, fascinated by the stories and pictures they contained. The third or fourth morning after I met him, he greeted me with a large smile on his face.
"I have a new game we can play," he said. "We have to wait. We have to wait until after your mother comes to check on you. Because she can't see us play it. Oh, no. It is a secret game."
After my mother delivered more books and sewed at the usual time, Mr. Wildmouth slipped out from under the bed and tugged my hand.
"We have to go to the room at the end of this hallway," he said.
I objected at first, as my parents had forbidden me to leave my bed without their permission, but Mr. Widemouth persisted until I gave in. The room in question had no furniture or wallpaper. Its only distinguishing feature was a window opposite the doorway. Mr. Widemouth darted across the room and gave the window a firm push, flinging it open. He then beckoned me to look out at the ground below. We were on the second story of the house, but it was on a hill, and from this angle the drop was farther than two stories due to the incline.
"I like to play pretend up here,"
Mr. Widemouth explained.
"I pretend that there's a big, soft trampoline below this window, and I jump, jump, jump. If you pretend hard enough, you bounce back up like a feather. I want you to try."
I was a 5-year-old with a fever, so only a hint of skepticism darted through my thoughts as I looked down and considered the possibility.
"It's a long drop," I said.
"But that's all part of the fun."
"It wouldn't be fun if it was only a short drop.
If it were that way, you may as well just bounce on a real trampoline."
I toyed with the idea, picturing myself falling through the thin air only to bounce back to the window on something unseen by human eyes. But the realist in me prevailed.
"Maybe some other time," I said. "I don't know if I have enough imagination. I could get hurt."
Mr. Widemouth's face contorted into a snarl, but only for a moment. Anger gave way to disappointment.
"Well, if you say so," he said.
He spent the rest of the day under my bed, quiet as a mouse. The following morning, Mr. Widemouth arrived holding a small box.
"I want to teach you how to juggle," he said. "Here are some things you can use to practice before I start giving you lessons."
I looked in the box. It was full of knives.
"My parents will kill me,"
I shouted, horrified that Mr. Widemouth had brought knives into my room. Objects that my parents would never allow me to touch.
"Oh, no, I'll be spanked and grounded for a year."
Mr. Widemouth frowned.
It's fun to juggle with these. I want you to try it.
I push the box away. I can't. I'll get in trouble. Knives aren't safe to just throw in the air.
Mr. Widemouth's frown deepened into a scowl. He took the box of knives and slid under my bed, remaining there the rest of the day. I began to wonder how often he was under me. I started having trouble sleeping after that. Mr. Widemouth often woke me up at night, saying he put a real trampoline under the window, a big one, one that I couldn't see in the dark. I always declined and tried to go back to sleep, but Mr. Widemouth persisted. Sometimes he stayed by my side until early in the morning, encouraging me to jump. He wasn't so fun to play with anymore. My mother came to me one morning and told me I had her permission to walk around outside. She thought the fresh air would be good for me, especially after being confined to the room for so long. Ecstatic, I put on my sneakers and trotted out to the back porch, yearning to feel the sun on my face. Mr. Widemouth was waiting for me.
I have something I want you to see, he said.
I must have given him a weird look because then he said,
It's safe. Ooh, it's safe, I promise.
I followed him to the beginning of a deer trail which ran through the woods behind the house.
This is an important path, he explained. I've had a lot of friends about your age. When they were ready, I took them down this path to a special place. You aren't ready yet, but one day I hope to take you there.
2 weeks after I met Mr. Widemouth, the last load of our things had been packed into a moving truck. I would be in the cab of that truck, sitting next to my father for the long drive to Pennsylvania. I considered telling Mr. Widemouth that I would be leaving. But even at 5 years old, I was beginning to suspect that perhaps the creature's intentions were not to my benefit, despite what he said otherwise. For this reason, I decided to keep my departure a secret. My father and I were in the truck at 4 a.m. He was hoping to make it to Pennsylvania by lunchtime tomorrow with the help of an endless supply of coffee and a six-pack of energy drinks. He seemed more like a man who was about to run a marathon rather than one who was about to spend 2 days sitting still.
Early enough for you?
My father asked with a hint of sympathy. I nodded and placed my head against the window, hoping for some sleep before the sun came up. I felt my father's hand on my shoulder.
This is the last move, son. I promise. I know it's hard for you, as sick as you've been. Once Daddy gets promoted, we can settle down. And then you can make friends.
I opened my eyes as we backed out of the driveway. I saw Mr. Widemouth's silhouette in my bedroom window. He stood motionless until the truck was about to turn onto the main road. He gave a pitiful little wave goodbye, steak knife in hand. I didn't wave back. Years later, I returned to New Vineyard. The piece of land our house stood upon was empty, except for the foundation, as the house burned down a few years after my family left. Out of curiosity, I followed the deer trail that Mr. Widemouth had shown me. Part of me expected him to jump out from behind a tree and scare the living bejesus out of me, but I felt that Mr. Widemouth was gone, somehow tied to the house that no longer existed. The trail ended at the New Vineyard Memorial Cemetery, where I noticed that many of the tombstones belonged to children.
I hope you enjoyed Mr. Widemouth by author Perfect Circle 35, as performed by Jonathan West. Up next, we've got one more terrifying tale for you. A 45-minute long epic from author Brenda Adder about the lengths some people will go to keep their reputations intact and their misdeeds away from prying eyes. As brought to life by voice actress Heather Thomas, I present to you Family Secrets.
The clock stood in the hall, one of the truly magnificent pieces of the Walter family's estate. The clock was made of heavy mahogany and showcased a large mother-of-pearl face with hands of sculpted bronze. Each hour the tall clock rumbled in the hall, resolutely calling the hour the passage of time. No one knew who originally designed the clock. Some in the family claimed it was made by an Austrian watchmaker by special commission. Others said it was given to the family many generations back as payment for some debt. No one knew for sure, but it mattered little. The general consensus was the same. Although the clock was magnificent, there was something oddly sinister about it. It was a hard thing to explain, really. It wasn't that the clock was ugly. Indeed, quite the opposite was true. It was heavily decorated with carved cherubs, shined glossy. The face radiated pink, blue, and ivory in the sun, while the heavy bronze hands moved about elegantly, their pieces intricately carved. Even the deep groan of its chiming bells resonated with a kind of stately grandeur. Guests to the house often stopped to comment on its beauty, but only at a distance. Even the most ardent admirers of its artistry rarely approached it directly. Indeed, most people walked by it quickly, suppressing a shudder. Even Nadia, one of Old Lady Rose's many descendants and the current owner of the estate, rushed past it when outright avoidance was impossible. In fact, the only person who seemed able to maintain her nerve in the face of the clock's strange atmosphere was Nadia's youngest daughter, Isabeth. At 13 years old, Isabeth was the quintessential misfit. She preferred books to play, spiders to dolls, and twilight to midday. Although she was both pale and blonde in appearance, she was a dark spirit drawn to all things macabre. However, even she was not totally immune to the influence of the clock. She'd never mentioned it to anyone, but she'd always felt oddly drawn to the elegant timepiece. Sometimes, as she made her way down the mahogany-paneled hallway, she felt as though it were actually calling to her. She found this somewhat unsettling, but also intriguing. She'd approach the wooden monolith with an odd mixture of curiosity and trepidation. Then she'd stare it down as though she were challenging it to a duel. Sometimes Nadia would catch her daughter in the act, her back rigid, her violet eyes peering into the clock's iridescent face, the way one might stare down an adversary. Nadia was never quite sure what to make of it. "What on earth are you doing, my dear?" her mother would ask. "The clock. It watches me," is all Isabeth would say. Nadia was always left standing, awkwardly, in the shadowy hall. After her daughter had gone, she would approach the clock gingerly, trying to feel what Isabeth had felt. But she could never feel anything but the vague uneasiness. Things took an odd turn when suddenly the nightmares began. Each night at 3 a.m., Isabeth would awaken, screaming. It was a blood-curdling scream, the kind that caused one to freeze upright in bed, unable to move. Servants inevitably rushed in to assist her. They always found her in the same posture, in a tight ball under the covers, face on knees. When she was extricated from her sheets, she always seemed oddly surprised, as though she'd been set free from a terrible trap. Then she'd roll over and go right back to sleep, as though nothing at all had happened. This went on for a fortnight. Various attempts were made to explain the sudden appearance of the nightmares, but no solution could be found. When queried, Isabeth could never really recall what had happened to cause her to scream, but she felt, vaguely, that it was somehow connected with the front hall and the clock. After 2 weeks of disturbed sleep, Nadia became desperate. The staff looked half dead, and she was at her wit's end. Determined to find a solution, Nadia decided that, since Isabeth seemed bothered by the clock, perhaps she should try having it removed for a while. She called some friends at the local antiques dealership and asked them if they would be willing to keep the clock for a spell. They reluctantly agreed. After all, Who would want to take on the protection of such an expensive heirloom? Removing the clock was a massive undertaking, but in the end, Nadia was glad she'd gone through with the operation. Almost immediately, the screaming stopped. Indeed, Isabeth slept soundly for another fortnight. After 2 weeks of peace, Nadia was on the verge of declaring the whole experiment a rousing success. However, she soon discovered that she need not have been so bold. On the 14th night, instead of screaming, Isabeth rose precisely at 3 a.m. In a dreamlike state, she walked out of her room, down the upper hallway, down two sets of stairs, past the landing, through the gallery, all the way to the front hall where the clock once stood. There, she stood absolutely still for about 10 minutes, and then, as if someone had snapped his fingers, she'd awakened, startled and confused. This was all discovered through pure chance. A servant had risen to get a glass of water because she couldn't sleep. When she entered the front hall, she saw Isabeth standing there in her nightdress. Then, while she watched, Isabeth seemed to stir and look around. It was clear the girl had no idea why she was in the front hall. The same set of events transpired on the following evening. This went on for another 2 weeks. That's when Isabeth began to see the girl. At first she was a small, clear light, strangely fog-like and murky. However, as time passed, she became more and more distinct. The first time it happened, Isabeth didn't know whether she should stay and observe the strange apparition, or run screaming from the hall in terror. She chose the former, much to the relief of the rest of the household. This went on for some time, the walking, the waking, and the seeing of the bizarre glowing girl in the hall. However, it was tolerated, because Isabeth didn't seem to mind, and neither did anyone else. No one was being awakened at 3 a.m., no one's sleep was being disturbed, and Isabeth rarely spoke of it. Indeed, a kind of routine developed. The only thing that seemed to change was Isabeth's location. Sometimes she was directly across from the clock. Other times she was kitty-corner from it. Sometimes she was down the hall farther. It became a game among the servants to bet on where she would turn up from one night to the next. Indeed, the serving staff drew lots each evening to determine whose sleep would be disturbed. In most cases, the servant who won would have to rise at 3 a.m. and take a peek over the banister to see where she was. The following morning, the staff member would report Isabeth's location on the previous night, and payouts would be made. One December night, Susan, the pantry maid, drew the shortest straw. However, her room was in a different part of the house than much of the serving staff, because her room was located right next to the kitchen. This is why, when Susan came to the front hall, she was able to see not only Isabeth, but also the little ghost. Isabeth had awakened several minutes before Susan's arrival and, therefore, had heard her approaching. Isabeth turned to look at Susan, but the maid seemed not to see Isabeth at all. She was completely mesmerized by the shimmering light glowing softly at the base of the wall where the clock once stood. Isabeth was completely unmoved by the sight of the ghost in the hall. She'd seen it for weeks. Instead, she looked at Susan and asked, "What are you doing up?" "Who is that?" pointed Susan, ignoring the question. "The girl," Isabeth answered quite naturally. "She comes every night." "Does she always look like that?" Susan moved closer, calmed by Isabeth's seemed indifference. She studied the strange apparition, unable to take her eyes from the figure of the ghostly little girl who sat with her face down and her knees drawn up. "Yes, she's always in that position. I don't know why." Isabeth shrugged. "She seems sad."
"Does she move?" Susan took another step forward. "Does she speak?"
"I've never tried to speak to her," Isabeth replied. "All I know is she doesn't move,
and she never looks at me. I wonder if she'd speak to you if you addressed her. She must be here for some reason, mustn't she? I mean, you don't just camp out each night in a drafty hallway for no reason, do you? Susan reasoned. I don't know. Isabeth shrugged again. It's not as though she can feel the chill. For shame, Susan said quickly, chastising her in a harsh whisper. You know not what she feels. True, but neither do you, Isabeth challenged. I suppose that's true enough, Susan admitted. A brief silence followed before she spoke again. It is odd, though, her sitting there like that. I feel like she's here for a reason, but I don't know what it is. Like she has something important to say, but she doesn't speak. Maybe you should try speaking to her, Susan suggested. I don't think she'd speak with someone else here. I'm not sure why. Well, maybe I should go back to bed then, Susan whispered before attempting to tiptoe away. Just then, the glowing figure faded in brightness and disappeared. She's gone, Susan breathed, walking forward suddenly. Aye, she does that. She's only here a short while, Isabeth answered nonchalantly. I wonder where she goes, Susan said, not really expecting an answer. I've often wondered why she suddenly started appearing. The clock was always there before, wasn't it? It's odd. I used to walk down this hallway after dark all the time, but I never saw her until recently, Isabeth replied. Susan grew brave and moved closer to the wall. On a whim, she began running her hand through the air near the place where the spectral girl once sat. She glanced absently at Isabeth and noticed the girl's confused expression. Slightly ashamed, Susan began tapping on the wainscoting instead. She wasn't even sure what she was looking for, really, except some clue as to where the ghost might have come from or where she might have gone. At one point, as she patted an area of the wall, she was startled by the strangely hollow sound that emanated from it. I wonder what that is, Susan murmured. What do you mean? Isabeth saw the look of wonder on Susan's features. Is there something there? I'm not sure, Susan answered, before kneeling down to knock more aggressively. She started near the place where the spectral girl had just been seen, and then moved down the hallway, rapping on the wall as she moved along. There was no mistaking it. The area behind the clock sounded different than the rest of the wall. It is hollow there, remarked Susan, walking back toward Isabeth. I wonder what it means, Isabeth wondered aloud. There must be an empty space behind the wall, Susan suggested. Maybe the little ghost has guarded something. Maybe there's a treasure. Or maybe a grave, Isabeth countered. Why must you be so morbid? Susan sighed. It's just as likely as a treasure. Who'd bury someone in a wall? Susan challenged skeptically. Someone who didn't wish to be found out, I suspect. Ugh! Susan shivered, looking up and down the long, dark hallway. Let's talk of something else. Isabeth merely sighed and began to walk back to her room. Will she come tomorrow, do you think? Susan pursued. Most likely, Isabeth remarked, not turning around. If she does, I think you should try speaking to her. Try to find out what she wants. Perhaps, was all the answer she received. The following night, Isabeth awakened at 3 a.m., and walked down the hall as usual. Again she encountered the young girl who sat with her back to the wall and her knees drawn up. Isabeth said nothing for several minutes, gathering courage. She pretended her bravery in Susan's presence, but there, alone with the strange apparition, she was terrified. Suppose the ghost was angry? Suppose it didn't wish to be disturbed? In the end, however, Isabeth collected her wits and spoke. Why do you sit there? She began in a voice that was barely audible. The ghostly child sat perfectly still, its posture unmoved for several moments. Then, as if roused suddenly, the little head came up, and the face of a young girl was clearly visible in its evanescence. And then a voice, like wind in dry grass.
I sit because I cannot stand. I stay because I cannot leave.
Isabeth did not answer at first, taken off guard by the sound of the voice. How often had she shared silence with this little ghost? Now they spoke, two girls in the same hallway, separated by time and life. "Why can't you stand?" Isabeth asked finally. "And why can you not leave?"
"I stay because I cannot leave. I sit because I cannot stand,"
the girl repeated. Never one to be sentimental, Isabeth dove into her questioning, determined to get to the bottom of the child's sudden appearance.
"Well, how long have you been sitting there?" "I cannot tell how long I've been here, behind this clock. It counts away the hours, day and night, and night and day. I hear the hours fly away."
"I imagine that's quite true," Isabeth began, noting the girl's antiquated clothing. "But you can't have heard the clock much lately. I know because we've had it removed. It unsettled me so."
"And what now?"
asked the ghost. "What do you mean?"
"Are you settled?"
pursued the ghost. Isabeth paused at this. "No, I suppose not. Here I am, after all, rolling about in the middle of the night. But I don't scream anymore, at least."
"So much better for the rest of them, I should think,"
replied the ghost with a hint of sarcasm. "Well, what of you? We're both here at this hour, aren't we?" spat Isabeth.
"I can't help it," snapped the ghost. "Who can blame you for what you see?"
And then, in a huff, she vanished. Isabeth was equally miffed. She crossed her arms impatiently and marched up the stairs to her room. The next day she told Susan everything that the girl had said. As she spoke, Isabeth noticed that one of the older maids in her mother's employ was watching them closely, listening to every word. "How now?" Isabeth said rather loudly, staring at the woman. "What do you find so interesting?"
"I meant no harm," Bertha answered, rising from her chair and coming closer. "I just couldn't help overhearing. You're talking about the little ghost, aren't you?"
"Aye," Susan began. "Isabeth sees her."
"The little girl?" Bertha murmured.
"Yes," began Isabeth. "I think I made her quite cross with me last night."
"She speaks to you?"
Bertha seemed surprised at this. "Yes," Isabeth answered matter-of-factly.
"I've never spoken to her, but I, too, have seen her," Bertha began. "Years ago, when I was a girl, like you. I think she only appears to young girls. Girls about her age who come into the hall when the clock's gone."
"When did you see her?" asked Susan. "Oh," Bertha chuckled.
"Many years ago now. My mother worked in the laundry back then. I was maybe 12 or 13 at the time. I remember that the clock was being repaired and had to be taken out. It was a rare thing, I recall. A clock that heavy isn't easy to move, you know."
Bertha paused, recalling events.
"I remember I woke one night, came downstairs, and saw her sitting there. When I asked my mother about her, she hushed me and told me never to speak of it. She was very superstitious. But I was a curious girl. When I could get no answers from her, I asked one of the other servants. It was Miss Watkins, the scullery maid, who finally told me who she was."
"Well, what did she say?" asked Susan.
"She told me a dismal story," Bertha began. "And I'm not even sure I have the right of it. Miss Watkins heard it second hand. It's a very old story."
She paused, gaining momentum, and then began to tell the story.
She was the daughter of a poor woman in town who came to work in the house. This was the time of old Lady Rose's mother, Julia, mind you. She was in her prime then, not yet 30, I believe. It was many years ago. Queen Victoria had not been on the throne very long, as I recall. This poor girl was ordinary in every way, except she suffered from a sleep disorder which caused her to walk about when she was sound asleep. Virtually every night she rose from her bed and walked the halls. After several years, it came to seem normal, and no one even remarked on it anymore. Indeed, the situation became so routine that the girl actually began sleeping in her slippers so she wouldn't catch a chill from walking on the cold floors after nightfall.
"What time did she rise?" Isabeth asked curiously.
"I don't know," Bertha shrugged. "But very late at night, I think. Just a few hours before dawn."
"Why?" "It's at that time she wakes each night," Susan answered, motioning toward Isabeth.
3 o'clock, Isabeth remarked. Bertha looked at her for several moments, a kind of sad interest spreading on her features.
"Aye, so it was with her. She rose and no one paid it much mind. It became routine, the way a thing will, given enough time. The situation was never cause for alarm because everyone in the house knew about her condition. However, things turned tragic one winter's night. It was right before Christmas. At that time, Christmas trees were novelty items enjoyed by the wealthy. They were, therefore, displayed in places of great prominence. That is why the front hall was chosen. The location offered not only a wide-open space for lights and decorations, but was also in close proximity to the marble fireplace where the stockings were hung. Well, on Christmas Eve that year, some thieves broke in, most likely drawn by the prospect of holiday gifts waiting there. You can imagine their surprise when, in the midst of their crime, they noticed a young girl standing in the front hall. She couldn't see anything, of course. She was just standing there, asleep. But these thieves would have no knowledge of her strained condition. They would have assumed that she caught them in the act. No one is sure what happened next, but it is widely suspected that foul play occurred. One of her slippers was actually found in the snow, several miles from here. Some assumed she was kidnapped, while others were sure she'd been killed and the body disposed of somehow. I'm not sure when the ghost first appeared, but it must have been several years later when the clock was removed from the front hall again. She's only visible when the clock is removed, you understand. It's said that she always appears in the place where the tragedy occurred.
Terrible, murmured Susan. Why do you suppose she's always sitting with her head down? Asked Isabeth.
No one knows, remarked Bertha.
She said that she could neither stand nor leave, asked Isabeth.
Is that what she told you? Bertha inquired.
Aye, Susan interjected. She repeats it, according to Isabeth.
It is odd.
True, 'tis strange, Susan stated. Clearly there's a mystery in all of this.
Well, there's nothing else for it. You'll just have to speak to her again, Isabeth, Bertha remarked. There's no other way.
That night, as before, Isabeth rose at 3 a.m. and walked down into the hall. The phantom girl sat, back against the wall, just as before. A soft white light emanated from her in the darkness. It was both comforting and eerie. Bravely, Isabeth addressed the girl again.
Why do you sit there? She asked.
I sit because I cannot stand. I stay because I cannot leave, replied the ghost.
Why are you not visible when the clock is in its proper place?
The clock is more than just a clock. It hides the spot. It hides the spot.
What spot? Asked Isabeth. A stain?
The clock, you cannot see. It hides the place that hideth me.
You make no sense at all, Isabeth fumed with impatience. You speak in riddles. Speak plainly. The clock, you cannot see. It hides the place that hideth me, the ghost repeated.
Isabeth merely shook her head, confused. She paced the floor for several moments, trying to make sense of the ghost's riddles. In time, the apparition disappeared completely, and Isabeth found herself alone in the hall, once more. The next morning, she told Susan all that she'd heard. Susan considered the ghost's riddles, shaking her head frequently. Suddenly, her face went white. She sat forward in her chair, her hand covering her mouth.
Have mercy. It can't be, she began.
What? Isabeth peered into the woman's face curiously.
She said that the clock hides the place that hides her. Old Bertha said that the girl's slipper was found miles from here, but that was just her slipper.
The girl isn't gone, don't you see?
She's still here.
You mean... Isabeth released the breath she'd been holding.
I mean, the clock. It hides where she is.
Susan looked Isabeth in the eyes meaningfully.
She's still there, in the wall.
Who would do such a thing? Isabeth exploded.
Aye, indeed. Who would hide a little girl in the wall?
And why would they get away with it?
Isabeth paused, realizing the rudeness of her next question.
I mean, wouldn't it smell? How was it not discovered?
I don't know.
Susan's head moved side to side very slowly. They sat quite still for several moments before Susan seemed to come to life. She took Isabeth's hands and looked in her face almost imploringly.
You know what you must do, eh? Tonight you must ask her. You must confirm it. If she says it is so,
what we think. Then we must open the wall.
Susan answered flatly, as though there could be no argument.
Aye, Susan nodded. She's been in there long enough.
At 3 a.m., Isabeth opened her eyes and found herself, once again, in the front hall across from the wall where the clock once stood. Within moments, she saw the little ghost appear opposite her. Isabeth began in the usual way.
Why do you sit there? She asked.
I sit because I cannot stand. I stay because I cannot leave, answered the ghost.
Where is your resting place? Far from here? Asked Isabeth.
I think you know. You do. Behind the wall. I am entombed,
the ghost replied. Isabeth tried to keep her voice steady as she asked her next question.
And who put you there, pray tell? Robbers?
The workmen came to fix the clock. They came and took it all away. They saw the wealth and began to plot. They planned to rob the house some way.
Isabeth almost snapped her fingers. It made perfect sense. She paced, speaking as she walked.
Of course they did. They'd seen the house. They knew its layout. They planned to do it right before the clock came back. Great-grandma Julia would have insisted it be back in time for Christmas. They decided to break in on Christmas Eve. Then they could reinstall the clock in the morning of Christmas Day. Of course, they'd be eliminated as suspects. Who robs a house and then returns to it the next day?
But what about the girl?
They didn't expect you, though, did they? That part wasn't planned. They didn't know about your sleepwalking.
The girl's face was turned downward once more.
But how did they?
She paused.
How did they hide you? Where?
In the wall? She asked. Finally, almost fearful of the answer. The ghost looked up at this. They shared a long, even look. Their faces were so similar. Their ages so close. They might have been friends, cousins, sisters even. Finally, the ghost answered her.
This house is old. It's not like new. This is no wall, but another room. You see me here, but not inside. Within you find the place I hide.
A second later, she vanished. Another room, murmured Isabeth. It isn't a wall at all. It's another room. There was a long pause as she considered this. How would they have known that there was a room behind the clock? They were workmen, not architects of the house. From the darkness of the hall, she heard the little ghost again.
I tell you true. There were not two that came for me that evil night, but three. But three came in to thieve and bury me without warmth or light.
A third man. Isabeth stepped forward. Another workman. Another man who came to fix the clock.
One who knew the wall was deep. No workman knows this house so well. Only heirs are privy thus. It was by his hand I fell.
Whose hand? Isabeth demanded. If it were a relative of mine, I've a right to know.
The heir. Own Walter's blood. The only male. The only son.
And then it was like a dam breaking inside of her. The old story. It made sense. All of it. All of it going back to when she'd first heard about her grandmother's Uncle Colin. All of it coming back to her. In the oddly vivid way that children recall the stories of long-dead relatives. She remembered Grandma Rose's references to Colin's quirks, his nervous twitches, his inability to relax, the number of brandies he'd drink in one sitting, his obsession with the clock remaining in its rightful place in the front hall, the way he'd become angry if anyone started snooping around the house. It all made sense now. She recalled the hushed talk about him, his gambling debts, his trouble with alcohol and women, the way he'd gone to ask for an advance on his inheritance all those years ago, and his parents' refusal. She imagined him planning it all out, him deciding to call in the workmen, men he'd probably promised a cut if it all went according to plan. But one question remained. How would they retrieve the stolen items if the clock was back in its place? There's another way in. Isabeth said it out loud. Of course, there'd have to be another way in so he could go in, get what he needed, and get out again without raising suspicions. And people never look right under their noses. Never. That's why they never found the body. She had walked some distance from the wall in her thoughts, but she stopped and turned back suddenly, walking quickly toward it. She put her hand on the wainscoting.
Where are you? She asked in a shaky whisper. I can't help you get out if I don't know the way in.
The way is here. Just here.
A light appeared, glowing softly on the wall just a few feet from where she stood.
Just pull the latch, and the way is clear.
She moved toward the light, allowing her fingers to roam along the grooves in the woodwork. Suddenly, she felt it. There was a small latch, invisible to the eye. Her first instinct was to pull on it, to open the door. But being practical, she knew she must wait until sunrise. Otherwise, she wouldn't be able to see anything, even with the spirit's glow.
"Wake me, will you?" she asked the ghost. "At daybreak. I can't see much now."
In response, the light glowed more warmly for a moment. And then went out. She noted the place on the wall. Then, moving into the front hall, she lay down on one of several sofas. Just as the sun peeked over the horizon, she woke with a start. It was just light. No one was stirring. She rubbed her eyes, rose, and walked toward the wall. She moved her hand along the wainscoting, searching for the lever that she'd found before. She'd fitted her fingers into the grooves of the wood where the light had shone softly a few hours earlier. Then, suddenly,
Her fingers caught on what felt like a bent metal nail. She wiggled this, curiously, her thumb finally knocking it loose. There was a sigh of stale air and a creak of ancient hinges as the hidden door made itself known. She pulled forward on the wooden door, suddenly timid. It was very dark inside. She knew she must enter to see what she must see, but she hesitated, fearfully, at the edge of the dark mouth that yawned before her.
"Do not fear,"
the little ghost whispered reassuringly.
"I am with you."
A soft light radiated in the darkness, growing brighter by degrees. Slowly, Isabeth entered the room. The air was sour, dank, stale, heavy. She felt sick in her stomach, but she moved forward. She had to. She felt that. This girl, this ghost, was depending on her in some way. She moved further into the casement. This had once been a private parlor of some sort. There were no windows, except in a small adjoining closet. There were plaster walls covered in fabric, with wainscoting underneath. There were several small couches, a mahogany table, and a trunk pressed against one wall. A trunk. Normally, an item like a trunk would have gone completely unnoticed. She would have scanned the room and made no note of such a thing. But there, in the room, the trunk took on a dark, oddly sinister quality. The words of the little ghost echoed in her consciousness suddenly.
"I sit because I cannot stand. I stay because I cannot leave."
A key lay on top of the trunk. Isabeth moved forward and took the key between her fingers. She contemplated its significance, what it could mean. A heavy hitching emotion rose in her chest, and she found that she could hardly breathe. A tear stung her eye as she leaned down to put the key into the lock. It turned roughly, pulling the rusted arm out of the sleeve. She was torn between two impulses: throw open the chest in one swift motion, or run away. She found that she could do neither. She was afraid to flee, afraid to look inside the trunk. She sat there on her knees for nearly a quarter of an hour. Then, turning sideways, she allowed herself to fall limply against the wall. She ran her hand over the lid of the chest, trying to will herself into action. She must do this thing. The servants would be downstairs soon. What would they say to her if they saw her in there? She took a deep breath, gaining resolve. Then she took hold of the corner of the chest and pulled upward. She did not turn her head at first. She rose to her feet and took a step away from the chest before turning. Inside, the girl's head was down, her face pressed against her knees. Her hair, once brown, had gone an ashy gray. Skeletal shoulders arched downward over bony legs covered in what remained of a dress. Isabeth scanned the small body and noted that her feet were bare. Why had they removed her slippers? Isabeth looked at one of the feet, pressed flat against the wall of the chest, and then she understood. The slippers might have allowed her to make noise. She could have kicked her slippered feet against the inside of the trunk and made just enough noise to alert someone outside of her presence there, which could only mean...
"She was still alive,"
Isabeth whispered, horror slowly spreading across her features. She looked at the horrid visage again. There were tethers inside the chest for securing items before travel. The men had used these tools to keep her largely immobile. Her mouth, all skeletal, was still gagged with the remains of a lump of cloth.
"She suffocated, or starved," Isabeth murmured.
And all the while she could hear the passage of time, seated here behind the clock that counts the hours. "That's what she said. How long did she wait here for the rescue that never came?" She looked around the room, seeking the little ghost absently. "How long did you wait? A week? 10 days? A fortnight?" Just then, a click sounded behind her. An adjacent hallway was revealed,
illuminated by the rosy glow of dawn's first light. It was lined with several old burlap sacks. Stepping forward, Isabeth gingerly opened a sack a few inches. Inside the first bag, there were several boxes wrapped in brown paper.
"The Christmas gifts," she murmured. "They must have hidden them in this hallway when they disposed of her."
She looked over at the girl again, sadly, before speaking again.
"They must have planned to hide them in here all along. But you changed things, didn't you?"
She spoke to the skeletal girl.
"They couldn't risk coming in here to get the gifts with you tied up in here. And later. Later they would not have come in because they were too disturbed by the thought of what they'd done.
But there still had to be another doorway. If the clock was put back, they'd had no way to access what they'd taken, dead girl or not." She began moving the burlap bags. She was sure the answer lay in the short hallway. She found her answer in the far corner. There she found a small doorknob hidden by some loose wall fabric. She walked closer and turned the handle slowly. The creaking door hinges grinded as the door opened by degrees. She couldn't believe her eyes. She recognized the table barring her exit almost immediately. She was in the parlor adjacent to the front hall. The table's location and height masked the outer door handle. How often had she walked through that parlor, unaware that there was a doorway into another room right under her nose? She had no idea the door existed, and she doubted anyone else did either. She closed the door resolutely, putting her back against it, sealing it once more.
"Well, I'd say you fouled that up, Uncle Colin," she began. "Oh, you killed a child and got away with it, that's true. But you did it for nothing. You never got your hands on any of this treasure either. Poetic justice, I'd say."
She would tell Susan everything when she woke. It would be soon, she was sure. Isabeth walked through the short hallway into the main part of the hidden room again. Out of habit, she scanned it, finding a small clock lying face up on the table. She walked toward it, noting its cracked face. "It must have been knocked down in a struggle," she mused. The time on the cracked face read 3 o'clock. A great heaving thing rose in Isabeth's chest as she gazed at the clock's face. So many years. So many years trapped inside.
"But you're free now," she announced through her tears.
Isabeth made her way toward the door and stepped out into the front hall again. She paused briefly, turning one last time.
"You need not sit, for you can stand. You need not stay, for you can leave."
Then, smiling, she turned on her heel and went to wake Susan. Isabeth couldn't be sure, but she thought she heard the jingle of laughter as she made her way up the stairs. The morning sun made its way through the curtains as winter dawn came on fully. It was time to get up.
I hope you enjoyed Family Secrets by Brenda Ader, as performed by Heather Thomas. If you enjoyed what you heard tonight, we'd like to remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word, and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website as well, chillingtalesfordarknights.com. It'll allow you to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. Finally, thanks again to today's sponsor, HelloFresh, for their support of this show. Don't forget, as a listener, you can get $80 off your first month of HelloFresh by visiting HelloFresh.com/CTDN80 and entering CTDN80. Once again, just go to HelloFresh.com/CTDN80 and enter CTDN80. That's CTDN80, all one word. The promo code will let them know that Steve and the team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights sent you. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure as always. I'm so glad you were able to join us tonight.
Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, a production of Chilling Entertainment and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted by yours truly, Steve Taylor. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering by executive producer and director Craig Roschek. Logo by Craig Roschek. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? We take submissions. Email it to us today at submissions@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. If you enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to us. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew each and every week. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. We'll be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.